This is Obscured, the podcast from Cuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and unfold largely out of the public eye. On this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we're focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma. I'm Emily Previty.
And I'm Stephanie Marudis. On this episode, we're bringing you a conversation about compensation and care for the exonerated. We covered this topic in the third episode in our series about Chester Holman III and the politics of wrongful conviction. If you haven't heard that episode yet, we recommend listening to it. We recently partnered with the Quattrone Center for the Fair Administration of Justice and Witness to Innocence to hold a panel on this topic with support from the Independence Public Media Foundation.
In addition to Chester, our panelists are Pennsylvania Speaker of the House Joanna McClinton and Herman Lindsay, who was also wrongfully convicted and exonerated, and now is Executive Director of Witness to Innocence. Marissa Bluestein, who's an Assistant Director at the Quattrone Center, moderated the panel, and you'll hear from Executive Director John Holloway as well.
Okay, good evening. Thanks for joining us here. We really appreciate your being here, and we're really very excited for this conversation and this panel on compensation for the exonerated, a topic that we feel is very important. This is a topic that the Quattrone Center has been involved with for many years, and unfortunately in Pennsylvania, we haven't gotten any better, so we wanted to talk more about it and make sure people understood how important it is. My name is John Holloway. I'm the executive director here at the Quattrone Center for the Fair Administration of Justice. And on behalf of the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, all my colleagues at the Quattrone Center, let me not only welcome you here, but our three wonderful panelists. And I will let my colleague Marissa Bluestein introduce them. But first, let me thank all of the people that it takes to put an event like this on. Our event team, our comms team, but also the great partners that we have, starting with Witness to Innocence, and we're thrilled to have their executive director, Herman Lindsay, as one of our partners. This is actually the first conversation that we are going to be having in partnership with Witness to Innocence, but we're planning a speaker series that will kick off next semester and go through the semester as we continue to help the more than 3,800 exonerees across the country tell their stories and help people understand the tragedy of wrongful conviction, the reasons why those happen, and hopefully learn from those to prevent others from happening in the future. I also want to thank our partners at Cuvenda Media, who are reporting this event, part of their Obscure Journalism Initiative, and the funding that we've received from the Independence Public Media Foundation. Cuvenda has a wonderful podcast called Obscured, and in particular, From Words to Weapons, and an episode of that dropped yesterday that features the story of one of our other guests here, Chester Holman. So, Chester, thanks for being here and helping us to tell your story. To moderate the conversation today is our colleague Marissa Bluestein, has worked with us here at the Quattrone Center for 4 years. We were so fortunate to be able to attract Marissa to us and get her work after 10 years of leading the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and many exonerations under her watch and have continued to this day. So, Marissa, I'll turn it over to you, but thanks for being here as well.
Thank you very much, John. So welcome, everybody. As John said, my name is Marissa Bluestein. I'm very honored to be here and to be with our very amazing panelists, and I'm just so grateful to all three of you for being here. Briefly, by introduction, of course, to my immediate right is Representative the Honorable Joanna McClinton, the Speaker of the House of Representatives for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, a former colleague of mine. Stories to be told later after certain drinks have been had. But obviously, Representative McClinton has been serving her constituency proudly in her time as a representative in the House and has made history this year by becoming the first woman and first Black woman head Speaker of the House of Representatives for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and a stalwart representative for those who are indigent and powerless, and a very, very strong voice for those in need. And we're so grateful for her time and her presence. Next to her is my very dear friend, Chester Holman, who had been incarcerated for over 28 years before he was released. So 5 years ago, about four and a half, July. So in July, it would be 5 years ago. And we're just very thrilled to have him. As John mentioned, he shared his story on the podcast, which I listened to this morning, which is terrific. And of course, Mr. Lindsay, who's always been introduced by John, who is the executive director of the Witness to Innocence. Mr. Lindsay himself is an exoneree, having served time in Florida on death row for 4 years before his case was unanimously reversed by the Florida Supreme Court. And those of you who know Florida jurisdiction, that is not an easy feat. But we are very thrilled to have you with us, Mr. Lindsay, and we welcome your voice. My job as moderator here is to just kind of set the table a little bit for us. The types of compensation that people can get upon release vary. There are 38 states and the District of Columbia that have statutes. They vary widely in terms of the amount of compensation, whether it's capped or not, what other provisions are available. Some require what they call no contribution clauses, meaning the person can't have confessed to the crime, even falsely, or pled guilty in order to receive compensation. Some limit it to DNA only, DNA exonerations only, and some even require a waiver of rights to pursue civil litigation in order to pursue compensation. There are also, of course, civil lawsuits. Chester himself was very successful in his civil lawsuit filed against the state. However, it takes a long time to receive justice following that, and it's, you'll see in a moment, not always successful. Then some jurisdictions, such as Florida, pursue what they call private bills to the legislature, an option which, by the way, is not available in Pennsylvania. So this is just some information about Pennsylvania and civil suits. Here, as I said, civil suits is really the only matter for seeking compensation in Pennsylvania. Of the 116 exonerees, we have seen 72 filed claims. Of those, there have been 31 awards. So in other words, 27% of all of our exonerees have been compensated in some form. Obviously, the vast majority have not. And finally, money isn't everything. In terms of compensation statutes, it's important to keep in mind that people have needs beyond money. They have needs for healthcare, for education, for housing, for mental health services, for family reunification services, for all kinds of issues that people face when they are coming and trying to return to society. And many of the compensation statutes which exist have some of those provisions in them. I've asked each of the guests to speak on a particular topic related to compensation and compensating those who have been exonerated. And I'm going to start with Chester. Hi, Chester. So as I said, Chester Holman served over 28 years in prison for another man's crime. When he came home, it was really to a whole new world. Automatic hand dryers, smartphones, innumerable other alienating developments. Unlike others with whom he was incarcerated who served shorter sentences, Chester had no access to training or education that would have prepared him for coming home to this new world. For people who are rightly convicted, if you do not know, when they are released, they have access to services. They can get help with employment and education and drug treatment and other issues that they may face. They go through a halfway house, so they're not just released from prison out. Chester got none of those. He got the news of exoneration, I think, the same day you were released, if I'm not mistaken. Not much time to prepare. He had no preparation at all, no way of knowing what he would face. He has described the experience, as you can hear in the podcast, if you listen to it, as having to flip from accepting that he would die in prison to being a free man. So readjusting to freedom has not even been easy. He has experienced nightmares, fears, and feeling lost. In the years since his release, Chester was able to receive a sum of compensation and currently works with the Urban League, helping people who are about to leave prison understand the world that they're coming into and what they will face. But Chester, my first question really is to you, which is when you were released, first, how did you orient yourself in that flip from thinking you would die in prison to freedom? And what resources do you think that people who are in that position need in order to be successful?
We had been fighting, like I said, almost 28 years, and I didn't have an idea of, that particular day, it was July 5th, 2019, I woke up and I went about my day, and we had been fighting, and we had been working with the Conviction Integrity Unit, Innocence Project, and my attorneys had been working hard to try to, right the wrong, but we just wasn't sure. This judge that we had was just always against us and denying all my appeals. So when the July 5th came, I got up that morning, I went about my day, and they called me back and said that you're going home. And I'm like, I just spent 26 years in this place. It's all I know. And to be released, I just didn't know what to do. And I called my family and my dad, and I said, you got to come get me. And they didn't believe it. You know, even though we had been fighting and there was talk that, you know, it was potentially I was going to be released, but just it, the way it happened, it was just unexpected. And when it did, you know, the whole institution had never seen anything like it. So from the staff to the inmates, everyone was just like crying and excited. And, you know, and for me, it was just like, I didn't know what to expect. You know, this is all, this is all I knew. I grew up here. And once we got outside the gates, you know, it was media and everything. And we went through all that whole process and then we left and we went to a Wendy's and I used the bathroom. And, you know, after I used the bathroom, I'm looking to flush the toilet. And I always tell the story and it's like, I just started rubbing the toilet and I'm feeling all around and I'm sticking my hand inside this urinal thing. It's a secret button, you know, and my uncle came in because he's the one that picked me up. And he said, just walk away. And when I backed up, the toilet flushed. And I didn't realize it was on a sensor. And in that moment, I said, if I can't flush a toilet, how am I going to make it out here in the world? There's no way I can make it if I can't flush a toilet. And, you know, the whole way home, rather than being excited for being out, I was just scared. You know, I'm looking at my father. He's in the front seat. My sister's next to me. You know, I just didn't know, you know, what was going to happen and how I was going to survive. And like I said, I know prison. I know how to survive in prison. I know how to watch my back. I know how to read the room and all these things. And now I'm free. So, you know, we went through that whole process. I got home, went through all that. And the very next day, you know, it was the media and all that stuff. But I wanted to jump right in into trying to get some help and, you know, reintegrating back into society. And we started calling places and different organizations and so forth. But everything was geared and set up for people on parole, people coming out of prison on parole. No one had yet seen or really dealt with exonerees, people who were no longer within the system. And so I went through this whole process and I couldn't find anything. There was nothing. And I got a little discouraged. And next thing you know, there was talk about compensation. And like I said, I'm just trying to figure out how to get my life together. And, you know, the attorneys approached me and we're going to sue the city. And that was the furthest thing from my mind, was suing the city. I wanted to make sure that I could survive and not lose my mind. And I was just so disappointed in not being happier to be home. You know, it was like frustrating to the point where it's like, maybe I shouldn't have came home, even though I didn't deserve to be there. Like, maybe that's where I needed to be because that's all I know. That's all I know. And so, you know, we went through the whole process of trying to find help. And, you know, I don't necessarily know if it came, but I did end up receiving some resources through the Urban League and the Marriage Reentry Program. And got a lot of support from the District Attorney's Office, Integrity Unit, Marissa and my attorneys. They all, you know, came together and helped me. But it was still, you know, I was missing something. So we went through that whole process and it was just like there was nothing there, nothing. And I kept being told that it was better off. I was better off if I was coming home with parole, you know. And finally, I was able to get on Medicaid, and I got on Medicaid, and then I was able to get my license or an ID, and that was the beginning. But I had no money. I had nothing. I came home with $97, and I tried to survive. And I, you know, I owed so much to my family and the people who fought for me. You know, I owed it to them. So that's where my drive was. You know, trying to give back to them because for believing in me and my case and fighting as hard as they did. So I think that's what kept me going for the most part.
And Speaker McClinton, to pivot a bit to you, if you don't mind. So given that many exonerations, if not most exonerations, there's really no fault. Right? These are cases which end in error, not through intentional misconduct, but maybe a misunderstood science or an eyewitness who just was led to a mistaken identification, not intentionally, but through the bad practices that they were using at the time. But given that there's very often no fault, what role does the state have in compensating people who were wrongly convicted?
So the state should have a role in making sure that people are able to rebuild their lives. We certainly know that there very few instances in which there's actual misconduct. Sometimes there is by law enforcement or by prosecutor or state attorney, but usually there is not. And as a result, people, as we just heard from Chester, can somehow lose 30 years of their lives where they're not living, they're not working, they're not in school, they're not having a family, they're not being productive and doing the things that we tell our children. This is what you do when you grow up. So the state has a role, and it's unfortunate that Pennsylvania is still among the short list of states that does not automatically have a fund available for folks to tap into. And their only mechanism right now is to file a lawsuit. And the other thing that's pretty unfortunate is the Pennsylvania Wrongful Imprisonment Act has several burdens for you to jump. So unlike all types of suits you learn about when you're a first-year law student, negligence, file a lawsuit, intentional infliction of emotional distress, file a lawsuit, you slipped and you fell, whose fault is that? File a lawsuit. When you're wrongfully convicted in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and you lose a good chunk of your livelihood to incarceration, then our state currently has eligibility. You've got to meet certain criteria. And you alluded to this a little bit in the introduction, including time that was spent incarcerated, wages that were lost. There might be a need for new eyewitness statements, evidence of innocence, because, you know, that's laying around. You find something in your recycling bin out front at your mother's house. It shows you were innocent. I'm being smart because it's pretty horrific that these are the burdens that still exist. It might require DNA testing. And a claim can be filed with the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons, and the exonerated or exonerees can have legal representation if they choose to. But it's a very complicated process. It's not easy. And unfortunately, there's so much more that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania should do. I'm happy to report that in my caucus, there are champions for criminal justice reform among us right now. And you were just in the Capitol 2 weeks ago, where our colleague Representative Rabb had a rally where we're going to make every effort this term to take the death penalty off the books in Pennsylvania. It's been long overdue, and it's been decades since, thank goodness, no one has had to suffer with that penalty, but we shouldn't even have it as part of the law. Representative Rabb has had a bill, I've had a bill, and I gave my bill to Representative Regina Young two sessions ago, and she is going to have it on the floor of the House coming up, perhaps at this next voting week. If it's passed in the Senate and goes to the governor's desk, it will provide some relief to people who are wrongfully convicted and exonerated. Under this bill, it creates new terms and a process so that exonerated individuals can bring claims. It would provide $100,000 for every year that someone's incarcerated serving on death row, $75,000 for every year that you're wrongfully incarcerated, but not on death row, and $50,000 for every year you're spent on probation or parole wrongfully convicted. And it provides a easier burden to seek compensation. And one of the things that really put the burden on my heart outside of the years being a public defender, seeing that the system makes mistakes every day, is being at a legislative conference, learning that Texas has one of the best statutes in the nation. I mean, there's so many other rights always under attack there, but to see that on criminal justice reform as it relates to people who lose their liberty and their freedom and their ability to have productive lives, they have one of the best laws in our nation to have easier access to justice. So we have a lot of work to do in Pennsylvania to right this wrong that we only know about a few. Sadly, there are many people who never have the opportunity to breathe the air on the other side of the wall and see what life is like and gain freedom. So we have a count, but that doesn't really reflect everybody who's innocent and incarcerated.
And thank you so much for making that point, Speaker McClinton, because that is such a critical aspect. We don't know the numbers. We know the lucky ones, that relatively lucky, that we have been able to identify. We don't know how many are left behind the walls, as you were. As I said before, Mr. Lindsey served almost 4 years on death row in Florida before the Supreme Court threw his conviction out, calling the state's evidence insufficient to convict him of the crime. In his decade plus of freedom, Mr. Lindsay has worked to help others understand the issues faced by death row exonerees and exonerees in particular, with a focus on understanding their mental health needs. According to a recent robust study, exonerees suffer PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, at a rate slightly higher than combat soldiers and higher than others who serve in prison as well. As the executive director of Witness to Innocence, Mr. Lindsay selflessly shares his story in trials to help forge change for others in our country. So, Mr. Lindsay, I'm hoping that you could talk to us a bit. We've heard about what the state owes to the exonerated. So what role do we in society have to help provide care and support to people as they leave prison, especially in a state like Pennsylvania where there's no state law to be able to provide those kinds of services?
Well, what I want everybody to first understand is that, one, wrongful convictions have different components, but only one component that they have that is in common with every wrongful conviction, and that's the jury got it wrong. The members in society got it wrong. Some didn't want to be there. Some didn't, you know, they might have a party or they just don't want to be in jury duty. People don't understand the importance of jury duty. So every wrongful conviction has the head of wrong jury, members of society. And one of the things that's been so hard for me is that I've came out and I'm like, Chester, I had no conversation. Till this day, I still don't have a conversation. Until this day, I still don't have my rights. I have to fight for everything that I want. I have to fight to get the wrongful conviction off my record. For years, they had me in the police system, as when you run my tag, it says that I'm out on condition release parole. It's not saying I was out as an innocent person. So when I'm driving my car and I get the lights behind me, not one police car come behind me. They wait till they get back up and they come out with guns, get out. And I had to suffer this for years and years. And this comes to the concept of people in society. We are in society. I don't feel society owe me nothing. I don't feel anyone owe me anything. I feel like I'm thankful for what happened to me because I believe that God took me through what he took me through to come out to be a voice. I'm a chosen individual that God chose to be a voice. So I had to go through that. But I do understand that society still judge me. Society, I try to go get just the other day I got denied life insurance because that murder is still on my record. I got denied an Airbnb account. You know, I used to go apply for jobs. For 14 years, I didn't have a job. Until last year, October, I took this job with Witness to Innocent. I couldn't get a job because even though I go show, quote, the unanimous Supreme Court verdict, something that has never happened in the history of Florida where all seven judges ruled I shouldn't have never even been convicted. I could show this to individuals and corporations, and they still were just like, no, we don't want to take that chance. And then the hurting part of it is that, well, they didn't have enough evidence, so maybe you did it. You know, it's so much negative, and it comes from society. It's not, I don't blame the state attorney's office. I don't blame the police department. You know, so we have some bad apples in every thing that we have. But as society, what I feel that society need to do is wake up. We need to stop getting involved in things when it happens to us or to our loved ones or to our friends. We need to get active and understand what's going on. Give our legislators the support they need to change the law to make it what it feels like. Do you know how it feels? You know you've been wrongfully convicted. You want to go file for a confession, but you have to prove you're innocent first. I mean, do you know the obstacles that we have to go through to get things done? And it's like a hurting feeling that is imaginable. But I think that it's not a matter of what society owes. I think it's a matter of what we need to do
as members of society.
Speaker McClinton, I think the first couple questions are to you. One is simply what can be done by citizens to support the bills that you mentioned. And the other is asking whether you feel there's an analogy to people who are seeking compensation for wrongful conviction and people who seek compensation for workers' injuries, that under workers' compensation laws, and in fact, I can share that Governor Wolf had a similar viewpoint when he was in the governor's mansion, that we should have a system that was more similar to the workers' compensation setup as opposed to a more tort-based. So I don't know if that's been part of the discussion in this, and if you can address that. If not, that's okay. But wanted to just give you that opportunity.
Yes, thank you. So I'll start with the first one. All of us have a role. All of us are voters, and we have people serving us in the state Senate, in the state House. I know prior to getting a job working for my senator, I did not know intimately who my representative was. So don't feel bad if you don't at the moment. But once I personally started working in state government under the state capitol, I got to observe that decisions made there, although it seems very far away and not hardly ever as a headline on our newspapers or on our news, the decisions made there affect us in every way. So I encourage you, wherever you live, to reach out to your representative. If you're in southeastern Pennsylvania watching this or here, 70.org has a very easy tool to find your local representatives and the ones who are in Harrisburg. Send an email. Many times you think, oh, that doesn't matter. But for at least the state reps, it comes right to us. It doesn't go to 10 other staff members. Other people could be copied on it, but it comes to our accounts. So send an email. Call our office, figure out a way to use your voice. Maybe I'll come up to the state capitol if time permits. If it doesn't, don't worry. Your state senator or your representative, they have an office near where you live. And once again, you might not have ever been there. In my case, I walked past many times, didn't know what was there because I was going to the L to go downtown to 1441 Sansom Street. Why would I be engaging with my state rep? For what? What was the goal? What did I need? I didn't need anything, so I never went into the office. But there are offices in your community. Reach out, let them know that this is important, because I can say when those emails come or even mail in the office, the district office or the state capitol, and I see the addresses, 59 such and such, I'm like, oh, that's around the corner from me. Like, those are my voters. These are my constituents. So it doesn't fall on deaf ears. And then on the second part, there is some discussion on what's the best approach and where can we get to common ground, because the thing that we have experienced thus far since I've had the gavel almost 8 months now is that we've passed, I'd like to think, 180 fabulous pieces of legislation, but in the state Senate, they've returned less than 10%. yes. So that being said, we have to determine what's the appetite on bipartisanship to get these from thoughts and fights and righteous movements to changes in our policy. And if that means having a better approach to comparing it to workmen's compensation, something that many people can relate to, you're at work, you get injured, now you can't work and you should be paid. That seems simple enough to me. The bill that's pending before the House, it doesn't use that type of formula, but it's definitely something that we're open to. No one person, especially in the state capitol, has a copyright on the best answers. So please provide your suggestions on how we can make it, especially sending it over to the Senate, more appetizing so that they can send it to the governor.
Thank you. Chester, I think the next one really, I think, is for you. So you spoke about this on the Obscured podcast about not getting acknowledgement from the state that you were wrong by them. And I don't know if you're comfortable, or Mr. Lindsay, if you're comfortable speaking to what that means to you. That it's one thing to get a check, but it's something else for somebody to say, we're sorry, and we acknowledge what you've been through.
When I, before we started the road down, you know, towards litigation against the city, you know, I had spoken to the lawyers and I said, you know, that they, you know, they started throwing numbers out and, you know, the process of what we're going to have to go through. And my whole thing was at that time, I was like, you know, it's not about money, you know. And my mother died in this process, my grandparents, you know, people I love most, you know, career, everything that I had, and I was in, before going to prison, I was in college, I was studying criminal justice. and all these things were just like taken away. So I didn't know how you could put a value or a number on that. So compensation was like the furthest thing from my mind. What I wanted was, and I pressed my lawyers to get the city to apologize publicly. Just like they put my name and my picture on the news and front paper. And, you know, I was plastered. My grandfather, I'm the third. I'm Chester on the third. My grandfather is a Baptist minister in the tri-state area. Was very well known. And with me being labeled as this murderer, it was everywhere. And what it did to him and you know, his name and my name, and it was just like, you know, so my whole thing was I didn't care about the money. I told them they can keep the money. I'll withdraw the lawsuit if we can just get them to come out and publicly say what had been done. And my lawyers were like, that's not how it works. He said, in order to make the state really feel this, or the city really feel this, you have to make them pay. And, you know, we went through the whole process and, you know, I didn't think there was any number that you could really place on a person's life. You know, I said, what is my life really valued at? You know, 10 million, 20 million. And, I didn't really care, honestly, about what the number was. I wanted, you know, justice in the form of just the way they took my life to give it back publicly. And, even though they, you know, I was awarded almost $10 million and, you know, even with that being said, after the fact, the city behind closed doors, a lot of people don't know, the city solicitor, he did apologize to me behind closed doors. But I wanted it publicly, but, you know, they didn't want to do that. The mayor didn't want to do so. They, it's behind closed doors, these things happen. And, you know, I settled for that. But, you know, I just want to say it real fast as to what he was saying about the compensation. Even though I've been given, I was given $9.8 million. My life is still no different. You know, it's like, even though I have all this money, I have a nice house and I have these cars, and I'm still treated the same way as if I didn't have the money. You know, I'm rubbing elbows with, you know, rich people and so forth, but they still see me as, you know, that's how I'm made to feel, you know, because the stigma of being in prison for 28 years is still on me. You know, this is what they think that I am. You know, this is who they see, opposed to the person that's been wrongfully convicted and then now exonerated. So what I did was, you know, just to make myself feel good, I put in to purchase a gun. And I said, let me see how this goes through. And it went through, and I was approved, and they, you know, went through that whole process, and I was given, you know, I bought it legally. And I said, now I know I'm free. Because I know what I got if I wasn't free. And just to do that, just to make myself, you know, remind myself that I am really, truly free, I did that. And, you know, it's a process. So you're not alone. You say, you know, compensation, having the money isn't all it's cracked up to be. I mean, it's helped me. It's allowed me to get the best therapist. I'm in therapy every week. I have the best therapist and so forth. But at the same time, you know, without that, I wonder where my life would be.
I don't know, Ms. Lindsay, if you have thoughts to add to that, but there was also a question specifically for you, which is about what's referred to as the clean hands provision on the compensation law in Florida. And if you could explain to us what that means, because I think it relates very much to what Chester was just talking about.
Actually, back in, I think it was 2017, the compensation bill was introduced. The reason most people didn't get compensation was because in Florida, if you had a prior conviction, any conviction, even if it don't have anything to do with what you was wrongfully convicted of, you could have did it 10 years ago, have any conviction, you were not qualified for compensation. In 2017, I was speaking in front of the Senate, and one of the senators and I asked, I talk blunt, so I asked the Senate, I say, well, how can y'all expect us to have a clean hands when y'all don't have a clean hands? Mm-hmm. I am a victim of the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most powerful Republicans that took it personal. And he said, you know what? Mr. Lindsay is right. So they moved to take the clean hand out. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand how hard it is in the legislation, you know, where one person... Luckily, we got a good person over here that determines what bills be said. But the House Speaker can tell what bills hit that floor and which ones don't. Right. And we have one that's down there that do not want to entertain anything that deal with the death penalty. So anything dealing with compensation with death penalty, he don't want to entertain it. So he decided that only way that he'll let the bill go through if they put certain crimes in them. So if you had been convicted of a robbery before or whatever. So in other words, it's saying that it makes it easier for the state to take people that's been convicted of a felon and wrongfully convict them, and there's no consequences behind them.
We do still have a couple questions on Zoom. There's a question then in the chat, and I think this is for Speaker McClinton, is if you know whether the current proposal has been modeled off of any existing successful state laws. And I would point out also that Kansas, I think, is one of the more recent states to pass a wrongful conviction statute, obviously a very conservative jurisdiction, but a statute which has been held out as a model for others by the Innocence Project, I think the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and others, for its simplicity and its ability to really get to the heart without overcomplicating the matter. So, but I don't know if the current legislation, if you're aware, Madam Speaker, has been modeled after a particular state, or if you're more about trying to accomplish objectives, I guess.
So it's the latter. It's more about trying to accomplish the objective of removing some of the hurdles that exist. As was said, people can access compensation, but you do still have too many burdens to be able to get your claim heard, trying to show that you're actually innocent, how difficult that is, and so many other things. So it's more for the immediate. It's not modeled after the Kansas statute you're referencing. And I would have to check in with our Innocence Project to see, I know they're supportive, but what the better bill would be so that it's something we can work on in the long term. I always like to look at the challenges with our criminal justice system and the progress as it totally being a marathon, not at all a one around the lap sprint. So with each piece of legislation that is able to get through the House and then the Senate, it gives us the next goal, because none of these statutes are perfect, because as I said, they have to become palatable to our Republican controlled Senate so that they can even consider taking it up.
And I think one of the proposals that or part of the proposals that are is in the bill currently and is in the Kansas bill, Nevada and others, is this implementation of society of services upon release, right? And I think, Chester, you spoke to this so eloquently before about what it would have meant to you to be able to have had access to mental health treatment or to assistance with housing or being on the state health care plan, which is part of the proposal here. And I know, Mr. Lindsay, do you see that around the country of other states trying to, that it's not just about money, that there are other aspects that should be incorporated as well?
Yes, but I'd like to jump back 1 minute.
Go right ahead.
What something about the bills that people must understand. A lot of times when we into this legislation and we're trying to push bills, you know what they mostly go by? Data. They go by polls in their areas. And if the more we can let the legislation in your area know that it's okay to set up a bill that will really compensate these guys. You know, a bill to say, okay, the death penalty needs to go away. If you let them legislators know, like she said, email them or whatever, that helps out to be able to get a bill together where it's fair. Because most of the bills coming unfair and so difficult because some of these feel like their constituents wouldn't agree with them or vote for them if they didn't be so hard right here. And it don't make sense to me, but that's the way it is. So I'd encourage people to write the legislators and let them know that it's okay, because the ones that we're fighting the clauses in this bill, I'm sure it's been suggested that clause of proven innocent be removed or some kind of other way happens. And the thing about it, I can present that Florida Supreme Court ruling, the highest court in the state of Florida, but still that wouldn't be significant to meet that requirement of that. But if people let the legislation know that it's okay to set a bill that these people need, they deserve compensation, then they will also fight for a better bill with those that's fighting. As you see, she's saying that they did 180 bills and only 10% come back. So that lets you know it's a fight in our legislation. And majority of those bills that has the heaviest fight is the criminal justice bills. And those are the ones that we need to get together as society and put together, because I fight every day mentally. You know, it's a mental toll on me every day. I live a struggling life. You know, it's very difficult. But one of the things that I do, I get up and I fight. Sometimes I cry. Sometimes I hurt. Sometimes I'll be in deep depression, but I still get up and fight. But the thing about it, I can't fight alone. I can't fight alone. And it only takes, I mean, you text your friends all the time, and it only takes a few minutes to email the legislators and say, I heard this exoneree talk, and he don't get a conversation because of this, and that's not right. And that would make a difference when she present that bill over there to the Senate, believe it or not, because they see a lot of people are really paying attention now to stop this from happening to me and Chester, because it's continuing every day. Every day a new case coming up, and every day a new innocent person is going in. In order to change this, we got to get the legislations to make the laws to prevent this, and we need society help.
And I think that related to that, to me, it's this question that, you know, Pennsylvania is in the very small minority of states. There's only 12, I think, that don't have a compensation law. Many very deep red states do. And I guess, Speaker McClinton, this would go to you. What do you think the obstacles are for passing this legislation? What is it that your colleagues, maybe across the aisle or within your own party, are looking for that they're not seeing in this kind of legislation?
I think that Herman hit the nail on the head, and it was, you said so much, you might have missed it, but I'll say it out loud, re-election. People who are in elected office want to make sure that come hell or high water, they can compel enough people in their community to reelect them. And for those who live either in New Jersey or southeastern Pennsylvania, I just want you all to take a minute and think about this time last year and the types of things that people were saying on television about John Fetterman. He had been our lieutenant governor, and the part of being the lieutenant governor, you chair the Board of Pardons, and he, you know, as the chair, was a very staunch advocate for criminal justice reform, for changing the law, for making sure that that board took its time with the backlog of applications and really gave people an opportunity to be heard, because we have so few ways for you to get out of prison once you're perhaps wrongfully convicted or rightfully convicted, however that goes. And he was a punching bag when he was running for the United States Senate. And people don't want to think that could be me next term, that could be me next year. So those are the obstacles. My time in Harrisburg has shown me anything, that people are interested in self-preservation. And they are scared many times to stand up and be champions, even when it's the right thing to do. I recall even before the lieutenant governor was running for Senate, we were on a panel together during the lockdown, or during COVID. I should call it COVID, not lockdown. very different. Very, very different. We just had to be virtual working. And we were both on a panel talking about how it was time to end second degree and the automatic life without parole. And in my caucus at the time, I was the leader, the first woman to be the leader, and they all have these wonderful group threads. And no one would send me a copy, but I was told by a member or two, everyone's freaking out because you want the murderers to get out of jail. And you're supposedly speaking for all of us. And in some of our communities, our constituents don't want murderers to get out of jail. And I said, well, let's start with second degree. How about we define that? Because second degree murder in Pennsylvania you're not the murderer. Interestingly enough, it's an odd way the words are written in our crimes code, but you are unfortunately convicted of as being a co-conspirator to the felony that you were trying to commit, whether that was a robbery, a carjacking, who knows. But you actually did not kill anybody. That's the irony. But, you know, there's a group of colleagues who get a vote to choose me to be their leader next term or not, saying, what's she talking about? Why is she out here, you know, on an issue that we don't support? And she's supposed to speak for all of us. She's not just speaking for West Philly anymore. So people don't always want to deal with that fire, that criticism. And because of the interest of, especially in like a place like Pennsylvania, where locally and state, there's no limits to how many terms you can serve. Well, I mean, there are people who've been there since the year I was born, and I'm 41. I'm just going to say that. It's a limit every two years or 4 years.
No, limit is what the society, society that goes back to, you know, the prosecutors. We complain about how the prosecutors make misconduct and the police do chiefs that make misconduct, but they're the ones that's getting voted in.
Yes, please. So if you're asking a question, please, there's a button on your microphone. If you just hold that down, see the green button, green light, and go right ahead.
Good evening. My name is Huntley Palmer. Let me first thank all the panelists. I have two questions, actually. In light of what Mr. Holman and Mr. Lindsay have said in terms of their experiences, and gentlemen, let me say this. I'm a former federal prosecutor. I'm over 15 years, both in the U.S. Attorney's Office in District of Columbia and the Section Chief U.S. Attorney's Office here. And I participated, this is the second program I participated in, because I think it's important for us to have an open mind as to what I try to accomplish when I was a prosecutor as being fair and just. And a wrongful conviction is a problem, far as I'm concerned. But listen to you guys, clear to me, one thing I want to say to you, Representative McClinton, listen to these gentlemen and seeing the emotion that they're displaying tonight and the commitment they're displaying to this effort. In terms of trying to move legislation forward, it's going to help exonerees. Should your bill include not just financial compensation, but automatically no dollar going to these individuals, that's a challenge, but therapy. I hear both of these gentlemen saying therapy is important to them. So state-provided therapy to help them in this transition seems to me should be, no one should oppose that, it seems to me. I would urge you to consider that be part of any benefit that should be allowed to someone who's exonerated and wrongfully convicted. I can't imagine any legislator having an objection to the state providing therapy to assist people transition back to the public sector after being wrongfully convicted. And just to you, gentlemen, I'm curious, because I'm thinking about accountability here. I'm curious if you can recall from your convictions, was it a result of, I would consider almost perjured testimony, misidentification? What led to your conviction, if you can recall? Is the individual misidentifying you, saying you were at the scene of the crime? I'm curious as to how that came about. And in your exoneration, what part of that testimony being pulled back influenced your exoneration?
So I definitely want to, on this one, actually yield my time, because I think that it is more compelling to hear from these gentlemen. And I wrote down the suggestion, and I'm going to take that back to my colleague as we work on the bill, because you're right. People focus on, you know, Medicaid, but what types of services are available and how are you getting the treatment necessary to, as Wesley said, to fight every day. And that comes through getting a full wraparound and support. And the fact that exonerees are the only contingency of women and men leaving state correctional institutions that have zero support. Zero. Absolutely none. It's good luck. Sorry about what happened. I mean, it's outrageous. So thank you for that suggestion, but please.
In regards to my fight, I guess the police file. I'll just say the police file. Which we don't have access to. We try to get I'll just say this, the same evidence that allowed my exoneration to go forth was there for 28 years. But because we didn't have access to the police file, it sat, and I just spent, you know, 28 years. But once we were able to get access to that, what they found in there was that the same night of the crime, there had been calls made pointing them to the people that did it. But they had already started to present, you know, put this case together against myself. And I guess, you know, they just buried that evidence. And like I said, it wasn't until Larry Krasner took over and he allowed us, you know, access to the files. And that's when they found in there. And then it just kind of blew things wide open after that. And the police file is, like, very important. You know, if we wouldn't have got access to that, I'd probably be in my 32nd year now, right now.
I was on a jailhouse informant for 12 years, according to the police investigating, for 12 years, he claimed he never knew anything about this case. I was arrested 12 years later for one. That incident happened in 1994. I was arrested in 2006. It was testimony and statements that was given that he admitted to someone else that he was the one that killed the person in the pawn shop. But during the police investigation for 12 years of the cold case, he kept denying it. He ended up in federal jail for the same type of crime this was, robbing pawn shops. In this case that I was arrested on, it was a pawn shop robbery where the lady got killed. He got arrested for a couple of pawn shop robberies, and the new detective took over, gave him a deal to cut some time off if he told him what happened. He said he was in a holding cell with me in Broward County Jail, and I confessed to him.
Special thanks to Pennsylvania Speaker of the House Joanna McClinton, Chester Holman III, and Herman Lindsay of Witness to Innocence for taking time to do the panel, and to the Quattrone Center for the Fair Administration of Justice, John Holloway, Marissa Bluestein, Anna Gavin, Angela Rivers, and Ben Hornung, as well as the Independence Public Media Foundation for their overall support of the panel discussion and the production of this podcast episode.
For more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media.
Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of our series.
Special thanks to Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative.
You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested.
I'm Stephanie Marudis, Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator.
And I'm Emily Previty, executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.